We'll cipher our way through another rain report in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. From the Minnesota studios of the Rain Report, I'm Kent Peterson, KC0DGY, with this not-so-clandestine Rain Report. Regular listeners to this ham radio podcast will recall the intriguing story about Russell Hutchinson, Radio Boy, the American POW who virtually risked his life to construct and listen to AM radio so he could help maintain the morale of the other 1,600 captives in a World War II Japanese POW camp in the Philippines. While Hutch was surreptitiously catching war updates broadcast by KGEI radio from San Francisco, the French Resistance and a number of other civilians on the other side of the world were keeping tabs on German military intelligence and movements, then transmitting coded data back to the Allies at great personal risk. Tom Pereira, Ph.D., W1TP, an authority on these clandestine radio operations, spoke at the 2015 Dayton Hamvention about the clandestine World War II spy radio operations in general. Here's part one of that presentation.
World War II developed really as a result of Germany being sectioned off into two parts after World War I in the Treaty of Versailles in 1919. And that treaty forbade them from having an army, an air force, or a navy, and it split Germany into two parts with Poland stuck right in between. And there was at least one man who was not at all happy about that. And if you look in his eyes, you don't have to be a psychiatrist to see the madness in those eyes. And he screamed and he yelled and he said, "We're going to get Germany back together again. We're going to fix this mess." And he built up an incredible army and air force and a navy illegally, according to the Treaty of Versailles, and instituted the Blitzkrieg. And the Blitzkrieg is lightning warfare. And he just went crashing across Europe, taking over everything, and literally took over entire countries. And when he took over a country, of course, his officers had to have some place to live. And they took over apartments. What they did was to take all of the furniture that they didn't like out of the apartment and throw it out on the street. They forced people to clean the apartment, and they simply moved into the apartments. And that's just one of the things that they did in their occupied behavior when they took over a country. This was not happy for the French, not happy for any of the countries that were occupied, and they developed a group of people which are known as the Resistance. Some of them were resistance fighters, and some of them were resistance spies. And here we see a lady with a perfectly innocent-looking pocketbook, unless you look very, very, very closely at that little point on it, which is the lens of a Rolleiflex camera sticking out. And she is taking pictures of German military installations to report back to England and to the Allies. Of course, it was very important for the Allies to get as much information as they could about what was happening in Germany and what the Germans were doing in order to be able to plan an invasion. One guy decided he was going to protest the clothes rationing. The Germans rationed clothes, and he decided he was just going to walk around without any clothes to protest clothes rationing. I thought that was just a great way to protest. And of course, there were more conventional kinds of protests. The groups would get together and attack German installations. So there was a lot of activity going on in the resistance fighters in countries that were taken over by Germany. And part of that required that the people who were resistance fighters build radio receivers and listen in to instructions from England and instructions from the Allies. The penalty just for possessing a radio receiver was death. So it was rather important that these radio receivers not be visible and that you not be caught by one. They would build a radio on a breadboard. We're all familiar with breadboarding radios. This one's pretty easy to see. So they got a little more clever and they started building them into suitcases. And then they got even more clever, and they started building them into household items, an electric iron. If you unscrew these two wing nuts and take the cover off the iron, you see that inside the iron is a radio set, a telephone book with a radio set in it, a furniture leg that's been hollowed out to accept a radio receiver, the birdhouse that they built a radio receiver inside. And again, with a penalty of death, you practically had to glue birds on this house so it would look look realistic so that nobody would take a peek inside. A phonograph that's been modified with its innards removed and a radio set built inside it. There are a number of museums, if you ever get over to Europe, in many countries, particularly in Denmark and in Norway and in France, where they have these radios on display. It's very impressive to see the ingenuity that people use to build these things. An oil can looks like motor oil, but it has a fairly sophisticated radio and a power supply built into it. Very neat stuff. This is probably the most well-hidden radio that has ever been discovered that they used. It was actually built into a plate put into your mouth, and it uses a very interesting physiological effect where if you impose an audio frequency into a person's mouth, they can actually hear the sound. You may not know that, and I don't advise you try it because some audio frequencies carry a fair amount of voltage, but if you look it up, you'll see that there's some fancy name for it, but you can actually impose an audio frequency in the mouth and receive information from it. Some people discover that when they have fillings put in their teeth that are of dissimilar metal, like a platinum filling and a gold filling put together. And when you bring your teeth together, it acts like a little diode detector. And people report being unable to sleep at night when they live near high-powered radio stations because they're hearing this constant music in their ears. Very interesting little phenomenon that was discovered and used during the war for this purpose. Most of the receivers were the Sweetheart radio receiver, and these things were cranked out by the thousands by the British, and they were provided to spies in all of the occupied countries. Very nicely built little tunable receiver, and the power supply earphones were used by the resistance fighters. They would simply string up a piece of wire someplace and hook up the Sweetheart radio and try to listen in to the broadcast from England, which would be giving them information about whether invasions were planned or what kind of information, what kind of specific spying information they needed during the war. Of course, the spies in Europe had to be able to get the information back to England and wasn't fast enough to send it by ship, and so they built radio stations, and the people who operated these radio stations were known by the nickname of pianists because they were playing the telegraph keys. And again, the penalty for doing this was unquestionably death. I mean, if you were caught transmitting a signal with any kind of radio, you were just shot. There was no question about it. So these people were very, very, very brave people.
You're listening to a 2015 Dayton Hamvention talk by Tom Pereira, Ph.D., W1TP. An expert in the field of World War II clandestine spy radio operations. We'll continue his presentation in a moment. This is The Rain Report, available anytime on therainreport.com, via Twitter at The Rain Report, and on iTunes.
You're listening to The Rain Report from www.therainreport.com.
A spy codenamed Paulette lived in France and transmitted information from France back to England using a spy radio built into a suitcase. She was a very, very important source of information. She came to Normandy before the invasion at age 23, a very extraordinarily brave person. She sent half-hour coded reports and then ran for her life, literally knowing that she would be found by direction finding within 1 to 1.5 hours. So it was a very, very scary process and very scary game that she was playing. And she deserves an incredible amount of credit for that kind of bravery. There were others, your typical installation with telegraph key, hidden spy radio, and a cranked power supply. And in order to know the information to send, information had to be gotten to these pianists. And one of the ways to do that was to put it inside a rotten-looking loaf of bread. Another was to carry it inside your mouth so you could chew it and swallow it if it looked like you were about to be captured or questioned. This is a spy radio in a suitcase, and this woman is carrying it. One of the things I discovered when I finally bought one of these things is that they're incredibly heavy. They have a very, very large transformer inside them, multiple voltage tap transformer. And so she was really struggling to hold on to this thing as she went up those steps, and you can see the frightened expression on her face. Well, it's okay if you take my picture, but don't show it to anybody. And here's a guy looking rather dapper on his bicycle, perfectly normal little knapsack with a normal-looking little suitcase back there that happens to be a B-2 spy radio inside that suitcase. So it was an amazing time with these people running around with these radios. And, of course, they would set them up wherever they could. A bunch of spies set up in the woods, string up an antenna by just hooking it over a tree and transmitting machine gun at the ready if any enemy show up. Two machine guns in this case, and another group of people using a radio with a hand crank generator back there, sending transmissions back to England. In America, we also had spies. This guy was masquerading as a ham radio operator. Surprise, surprise. I don't know his call letters, but you can see the Hallicrafter's radio over here and his pet dog over here. And he was just simply sending coded messages back to Berlin from New York City. We grew up at that time. I was about 5 or 6 when World War II was going on. So everybody was a spy. You looked around, you, that person looks like a spy, or that person looks like a spy. My grandmother was particularly good at that. She thought she could spot spies, and she'd look at people, and she saw one guy going in and out of a building very often. She said, he's a spy. I'm going to call the FBI. Can you imagine how many people called the FBI at that time? Well, it turned out she was right. And this guy was living on the top floor right in that apartment. I researched this thing, and he had a radio station set up there, and she actually participated in alerting them and capturing this German spy. So you never knew what was going to happen during the war. What kind of radios did these guys use? Well, they used a number of different kinds, but they again had to be rather well camouflaged. And there's an extraordinary book that covers all of the clandestine radios that were used during the war, most all. I think he's got maybe 95% of them by Louis Mulsti. And he has a wonderful website if you just Google Mulsti. His book is very expensive. It's about a $60 book, but on the other hand, it has hundreds and hundreds of pages of not only descriptions of spy radios, clandestine radios, but also circuit diagrams, which is kind of fun for those of us who like to read light reading. Here's another great book by Perquin, The Clandestine Radio Operators, and he shows a lot of pictures and tells a lot of stories about these guys, the pianists who were sending information back. The typical radios that were used, many of them were made in Britain, designed by British hams, surprisingly enough. This is a British spy radio called a Type A Mark II, a receiver and a transmitter and power unit and a classic telegraph key down in the front. It's a paraset designed to be dropped with paratroopers behind the enemy lines, so it's a little bit more rugged set. It's not hidden as well, although if you look, you can see the leather case that sort of encloses it. There are a fair number of these, many, many hundreds of them, because they are out there. You can even find them on eBay occasionally. They generally sell now for about $10,000. They're pretty desirable collectibles, but they're worth it because they're a real piece of history. The circuit diagram has a standard crystal oscillator, and there are plug-in crystals that would determine the frequency. You feed that into the power amplifier tube. It has a tuned circuit and feeds out into the antenna. So it's a very, very straightforward transmitter. The receiver is also quite straightforward. It has 3 bands feeding into the grid of the receiver and tuned circuit, and we go through this coupling transformer into the IF stages. We have another IF with a local oscillator and feed that into an amplifier detector and out into the headphones. So just exactly the simplest kind of circuit you could possibly imagine. The power supply itself was fairly tricky because that darn transformer that weighs so much had all these different windings on it, so it would work on 6 volts, 12 volts, 110 volts, 220 volts, and so on. For the DC voltages, it had a vibrator, which changes DC into pulsating AC, and you need that in order to feed it into the transformer, for those of you who aren't familiar with vibrators. Very straightforward radio, but very effective, and the ability to operate on 3 bands, I think from about 80 meters up to 20 meters approximately, allowed them to get pretty good propagation depending on the time of day. The power supplies were hand-cranked power supplies typically, unless they were lucky and operating in a building and could hook into the AC line, either a manually cranked generator or a generator that was hooked onto a bicycle to build up the RPMs. They could take basically any old DC motor and spin it up at the right speed and generate the voltages that they need. There were also military generators with a seat and a foot crank for bicycle pedals down at the bottom, and they worked very efficiently.
This concludes the first of two excerpts from a 2015 Dayton Hamvention talk by Tom Pereira, Ph.D., W1TP, an authority on World War II clandestine spy radio operations. We'll resume his talk next time. Before we go, however, we need to say goodbye to an old friend and former Rain reader and now Silent Key, Dwayne Whittingham, N9SSN. Dwayne had been battling kidney-related issues over the past few years. He was in his 40s. Dwayne's niece, Ashley, has set up a GoFundMe account to raise money to have him buried in Lowell, Indiana, alongside of his mother and grandmother. The Dwayne GoFundMe web address can be found on the site's mentioned page on therainreport.com. Farewell, old friend. The Rain Report is copyright 1990-2016 Rain. All rights are reserved. If you're headed to the Dayton Hamvention in a couple of weeks, be sure to drop by booth 329 and say hello to the Radio Amateur Information Network and the Gateway 160-meter radio newsletter. Now for Rain's founder and producer, Hap Holly, KC9RP, I'm Kent Peterson, KC0DGY, bidding you a very 73. From all of us at The Rain Report, www.therainreport.com, on Twitter, @TheRainReport, and somewhere on iTunes.